SBS
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 SBS Radio.
Dr. Jonathan Bain is a researcher at Deakin University here in Melbourne, Australia. Last year, he completed his PhD study, and the title of his thesis was Ambivalent Motion, Eritreans' Work Pursuits and Intercultural Connections in Melbourne. It examines how highly educated Eritrean migrants relate to novel environments and forces they encounter in Australia. Motivated by a series of gaps in research and theorizing on migrant lives, including insufficient attention to migrants' capacities to act, experiences beyond resettlement, and groups from certain national, education, and work backgrounds. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Jonathan.
Thank you very much, Akanyele. Appreciate being here. Thanks for the opportunity, and also thanks to everyone who participated in the research. Much appreciated.
Also present here are Dr. Emmanuel Elias, a researcher at Deakin University, and Bayena Samara, executive producer of SBS Grinya. My name is Ibrahim. If I may start our conversation, first, congratulations on your work. Why Eritreans?
Thanks, Ibrahim. I might say a couple of words about the background to the research to explain that. My own personal background, and sort of academically speaking, is in anthropology, and I've been interested for a while in topics like intercultural connections, racism, migrant lives, and started a PhD around these topics. I've also been interested in challenges that migrants face in Australia, and that's been in the framework of the project kind of more generally. And at first it wasn't really framed around a particular group from any national background, and gradually over time, especially informed by my personal connections, acquaintances, friends, it took gradually more and more Eritrean direction. Here we are.
So what did you find about Eritreans, specifically in Melbourne, in terms of their works and all their lives?
So I've found the study focuses on Eritreans' work pursuits and intercultural connections. And it's essentially divided into four kind of main chapters that look at issues like discrimination, intercultural connections, concept of conviviality, which means living together in difference, so how that happens. Also looked at local experiences and inhibition and exclusionary mechanism in work settings. And precarity, which is a sense of vulnerability that I looked at in relation to work and in relation more generally to life. So I looked at each of these, framed it within a chapter. Mm. And so to your question, there's specific findings for each one of these, but also more generally for the thesis, like as a whole, it looked at the ambivalence that I found that Eritreans are experiencing, the kind of potentialities, the kind of capacities that they have for moving through work, moving through the social connections, moving through life generally, more existentially also. Moving also, there's a sense of social mobility, moving in terms of the class positions in Australia. And I also looked at the nature of exclusion that they've been facing. So I found that exclusion is, in Australia and specifically in Melbourne, exclusion is more subtle, that it's experienced maybe more institutionally, vicariously, so through other people, through witnessing and knowing about the experiences of other people. And also that intercultural connections, especially with Australians, especially with local Australians, it can be quite limited. The thesis is also framed around mobilities and action and agency and how people are really navigating these different structures and barriers that they are meeting in Australia.
For the sake of your work, you had to do some background research on how Eritreans arrived in Australia.
The thesis looks at the history of Eritrean migration kind of fleetingly, as really as a background, as an orientation to what's happening right now, and then going also back in history, into the history of, so individuals' history of migration. But looking at Eritrean history of migration more generally to Australia, we know from the ABS that there have been very few people who've already come to Australia in the 50s, 60s and 70s. And then very broadly, we can make a distinction between people who've come before 1983 and after 1983. Before 1983, we know people have come mostly as refugees and stowaways and as students on UN scholarships. And in 1983, we have something of a watershed moment where there's a federal election, Labor gets into power, the Bob Hawke government, and then in the sort of fallout, the aftermath of the Red Star campaign, the bloody round of fighting with Ethiopia, we have a special quota that is given for humanitarian migration from Eritrea. So from 1983, there are 3 years when Eritreans receive these special quotas of about 100 people a year that are accepted in Australia. Towards the end of the 1980s, we also see an involvement, so really mid to late 1980s, we see an involvement of some key public figures, including Thomas Keneally, who wrote Towards Asmara, Fred Hollows, of course, the first honorary citizen in Eritrea, and the involvement of ERA has been quite fundamental to increasing public awareness and really bringing Australian onto the Eritrean cause around that time. Yeah, the people who have come in these later years of the 1980s or so have settled mostly, we know, in Springvale and Maribyrnong, that's within Melbourne. And we know that by the end of 1990, there were 270 people who reported to be born in Eritrea, who lived in Australia at large. Most of them lived in Melbourne. From that period and onwards, we see an increase in migration, and we can then again roughly divide migration maybe into two cohorts. One that is linked fundamentally to the liberation struggle, the aftermath of that, people fleeing Eritrea and the region and other countries that they've moved on to from Eritrea. And a second, more recent one that is related to fleeing the current regime. So that's based on current numbers, and current is really 2016. And maybe we need to make like a small comment about the reliability of ABS data, which a lot of that is really based on. ABS data is, what we could say, quite flawed in grasping really where people have come from, in engaging a bit more deeply with the circumstances of the migration.
So we are talking about the Australian Bureau of Statistics, yes. Census. Yeah.
We know from Department of Social Services data that most people who've come to Eritrea between 1991 and 2018 came as humanitarian backgrounds and on family visas. It's like the overwhelming percentage. And we know from ABS data that numbers in Melbourne have increased fundamentally in the 1990s. There's a small decrease again in Melbourne in the 2000s, and an increase, slight increase again 2011 to 2016. For the actual demographics, so I'm talking specifically about Melbourne now, which was the focus of the study, 53% of the Eritrean born population in Melbourne who are female, about 50% who are between the ages of 40 and 59. We see quite a scattered pattern in terms of demographic where people actually live in the city, which I think is quite interesting, where people are living in 107 different suburbs. So that's a separate kind of analysis that, that I looked at through ABS data. 107 suburbs out of 321, which is exactly a third of Melbourne suburbs where Eritreans are living.
Scattered,
yeah. So it kind of speaks to, know, we can talk about notions of community maybe a bit more and how that relates to that. About 2,000 who live in Melbourne, slightly less, 1,980, 2,000 who live in Victoria, out of 4,300, that's back to 2016, who live in Australia. And that includes just really the first generation, so people born in Eritrea. If we also count their children, born in Australia, born in other countries. In Australia, we need to add a few more thousands of people. In Melbourne, which again was my focus, it brings us to about 4,600 people who are either born in Eritrea or are children to Eritrean parents.
So, Dr. Emmanuel, the Eritrean community is still considered as an emerging community in Australia. So it's still, although there is a history, as Dr. Jonathan explained, of kind of scattered or staggered arrivals in Australia. So do you have any idea why the sense of community is not there? They are scattered, for example, in Melbourne, in different localities rather than forming a certain kind of contained community within a certain location or suburb in Australia or in Melbourne?
In my understanding, Eritrean migrants in Australia are, we can say it's first generation, predominantly first generation migrants. And as first generation migrants, they still, we can say Eritreans are in the stage of finding themselves in Australia or establishing themselves. So we cannot conclude that the Eritrean settlement in Australia is concluded. Still, people are navigating and negotiating where to stay, where to establish themselves, what kind of activities and what kind of jobs to secure, what kind of business to establish themselves. That's my understanding. Maybe unusually, unlike other communities which came to Australia and are known for settling in certain locations. Of course, they are predominantly in Melbourne and to some extent also in Brisbane and Sydney. There are also some Eritreans in Perth. What I understand is as time goes by, people will kind of move around until they settle in specific locations where they will have their own communities. Not only that, but also they will have, like other communities, they will find it better to settle in a certain location. So we are still seeing this.
Navigating
and still taking shape. We can add, though, kind of more generally about the areas within Melbourne. There are some patterns that we can definitely speak to. So if we are looking at different parts, we see that about 44% are settled in the western suburbs and about 32% in the inner city. And that kind of sits with some of the analysis for migrants from the Horn of Africa more broadly, where there's a thesis from about a decade ago where they found that migrants from different countries in the Horn of Africa, especially after 1983 when Labour government came into power, and quite a lot of people have been moving, first of all, to Melbourne, as you say. Victoria has been really the most popular destination, followed by Queensland and West Australia and then New South Wales. But then also the different reasons why people have been moving specifically to Melbourne, such as family connections that have started to become more popular for people, wanting to start a business, finding quite a lot of services in here. Work, I think, is a really important one. And also just socializing and feeling comfortable in areas where there are other people who share their background, their language, culturally and so forth.
But why western suburbs are chosen by many migrants, including Eritreans, to settle? Is it because there is access to job or something? What are the reasons?
I think presently it's kind of hard for me to speak about the beginning because I haven't really spoke to people about, you know, the first generation who moved specifically to the West. I imagine that it was easier also financially because back in the day, the area was really building up. And then I think for people currently, for the people that I spoke with, it seems to be really their connections, you know, having family, having these kind of services, areas where they could socialize and potentially link up with work and housing opportunities and so forth.
Also, I might add that people are moving into the West predominantly nowadays because people are owning houses, they are mortgaging, and it is natural that it's cheaper in the western part of Melbourne than in the east and the north, maybe to some extent. So the housing affordability is also one issue that's pulling people towards the West, relative to other areas.
So, Dr. Jonathan, in one of your parts of your thesis, mm-hmm. you analyzed the work pursues that Eritreans go through,
yeah.
and their journeys, like in terms of successes and challenges. I will read some of the things that your participants said with respect to discrimination and challenges they face in their workplace, daily lives. So for example, one of your participants said, so for me, I saw that it's also my responsibility to break that barrier and try to go and talk to people when people ask me. I don't have to wait. So if someone takes one step, you have to take two steps so you can be closer. People might be naive or might seem to be racially discriminatory if they have never met someone, you know, like myself or talk to me. So this is one of the perception that one of your participants had. And the other participant, some of the employers, they might call you by phone if the job is related, for example, with dealing with customers. And if you have an accent like mine, the employer cannot or trust you to be just to put you in there. So people feel like, oh, because of our accent, we cannot get that kind of job. So we better not apply for that kind of job because we don't have that accent in communication, even if we have the ability to deliver what's required. So what are your findings telling us?
Mm-hmm.
So what does this indicate with respect to the Eritrean migrants and their pursuit for work and success?
Sure, sure. Let me start maybe with the second quote. This is an experience that is relayed by someone who themselves said that they haven't personally experienced discrimination, for example, in the workplace, but then is aware of discrimination as occurring more generally. And so the person I was speaking to in the second quote that you just brought, they're talking about how other people are maybe being a bit reserved about some of the jobs that they'll be applying for because they expect the discrimination might be a factor in the kind of decisions around working in certain jobs that require you to sound more Australian, for example, to have an accent that... It sounds like is maybe more Anglo or European.
Mm.
So in that case, I think it's an example for how discrimination may not be personally experienced by some people that I spoke with, but at the same time, people were very well aware that discrimination is occurring to other people and kind of more generally. So we can talk back to kind of more academic-y words. We can talk about vicarious or structural discrimination and how the experiences of these kind of broad experiences can be quite different to the interpersonal forms of discrimination that people may or may not have experienced. And so the second quote, or the first quote really, by the person we said, whose name Noor in the dissertation, is showing, I think, quite a lot of goodwill in the sense of explaining people's discriminatory behavior. And I found that to be a bit more general also, as in applied to also other people who will be excusing some people as rotten apples, if you may, as extreme cases, or just ignorant. Not really, really racist, just a little bit ignorant and something that could be remedied. And again, it's something that reflects in that instance personally maybe to these rotten apples, but doesn't really implicate Australian society as a whole. So I think these two quotes really speak to these findings in the thesis.
Do you think among Eritreans there is a unique way of explaining away discrimination relative to the general findings across different groups?
I have read some of the comments that are given by the participants that they cannot express that there is real discrimination in general. So they say, I can't say, yes, I don't know, something like that, I think. So is it because there is no discrimination that they don't feel it, or what is their expression of the participants in terms of the discrimination that is existed in Australia?
Maybe I can try and bring in both of the questions together and talk about the chapter on discrimination a little bit. So I found that people have experienced different forms of discrimination. The forms that people spoke about more commonly were related to Islamophobia and were brought up mainly by people from Muslim backgrounds. And people, like we said before, people were familiar with discrimination as occurring kind of more generally. They knew that at work it might be something that would be used against them. And they knew also of experiences of others, and some of them have done that themselves, of changing their names on CVs, for example. A couple of people were much more concerned about institutional and structural discrimination. For example, how the city is segregated, you know, where people live and watch. In which neighborhoods, and discrimination in an area like the labor market that you cannot really grasp. It's much more abstract than the kind of person-to-person discrimination. Mm-hmm. And the person-to-person discrimination was something that a lot of them really downplayed. And so, Amani, back to your question. This downplaying was quite common. The pervasiveness of discrimination, but especially the impact that discrimination may have had on people I spoke with, many people really dismissed it. They said, oh, maybe it has occurred or it has occurred, but it doesn't really get to me. Mm-hmm. And so kind of jumping off these experiences, I try to look at all the different reasons why people may downplay discrimination altogether. And there's some research, some indications from past research that, a bit like what you were saying before, other groups of migrants are reporting discrimination quite frequently. And there's even one study that had an Eritrean, small Eritrean group, so we can use that as an indication in terms of like the size of the sample. It might not be enough to actually make big statements. But Eritreans were really reporting discrimination far less than any other group. Mm. So that's quite interesting, I found. Just really in a nutshell, the different reasons that I could identify had to do with perceptions, especially among newcomers who may not perceive discrimination as occurring, and people spoke about that quite frequently. So for example, not being able to read people's faces in Australia. There are a couple of people who spoke about how in Eritrea you can know if somebody is not happy with you, you just look at and see it on their face, whereas in Australia, even after a couple of years, they're still not entirely sure somebody was not happy with them. Obviously, interpreting discrimination in context, you know, a lot of discrimination can be more subtle in Australia, and people spoke about that. Also, there's a comparative framework that I found that people were using quite a lot. So comparing the kind of milder, effusive, if you may, abstract discrimination that may or may not occur with forms that are really in your face, kind of violent, also definitions of discrimination and racism back from Eritrea, where it's, you know, it's something that really malicious bad people would do, and you would know about this, and experiences that people have had in places like Sudan and in places outside of Eritrea and in other countries, be it in refugee camps, being in other cities as migrants and people of color and so on. And compared to that, Australian discrimination, you know, might be a bit vindicated in their eyes. You know, something like, I'm putting quotations, something petty. Like, why would you even report that, right? And of course, it also goes back to the kind of wider history of racism in Eritrea, where we're thinking of these blatant historical forms under the Italians and other occupiers. Another reason for downplaying discrimination had to do with the gratitude that a lot of people have felt towards Australians and Australian society. These really generous people who have accepted us here, that I'm just kind of narrating the gist of it. What sense would it make now to report that or complain that somebody said that they felt like Australians could do anything they like after they let us in? So there was that also. Meritocracy or meritocratic ideal. Merit basically is the idea that with opportunities being more or less equal and people having high skill and working really hard, that they would be able to succeed. And I found that a lot of people had these values around hard work and around the possibility of successes, where they also, of course, saw some people around them who were moving on up. And they thought that that meritocracy really as such will not really stack up with discrimination, or holding on so strongly to meritocratic ideal doesn't really sit with reporting discrimination. So that was another reason. And also just more generally about control and power. People very keen to assert themselves as powerful agents who are not victims, who are in control of their lives. And once you acknowledge discrimination, you give it that kind of power and you bring it center to an extent that I felt like a lot of people were not really willing to do. The chapter speaks about how ambiguously Eritreans who spoke about discrimination stood in relation to anti-racism, for example. So on the one hand, people did not report it very often, and they also spoke about other people who were reporting discrimination as maybe complainers, some people.
Whiners, yeah.
Yeah, stuff like that. So that would seem to go against anti-racism as such. As reporting discrimination, based on the realization that reporting is really crucial for us to confront racism, which kind of goes also to some of the work that I've been involved in later on. And I think that's absolutely critical at a sort of broader level. This is a whole other topic maybe. So, you know, on the one hand, we have this way of going against anti-racism. On the other hand, you're asking about benefits. I don't know how beneficial it is, but some people have spoke about these ways of putting less attention maybe on discrimination and focusing on working hard in this kind of like pragmatic sense as a way to just try and move on as well as they can. Mm-hmm. And I think for some of the people who shunned people who were, in their opinions, again, not mine, in their opinions, complainers, for example, I think they were trying to move on as best as they can practically, acknowledging that the playing field is not as equal as we'd like for it to be, but still trying as best as they could to move on and discouraging other people from reporting discrimination, which, again, is very much arguable whether that's, you know, beneficial.
Yeah, in terms of the people who have some skills or educational background, I'm sure we have some participants with bachelor degree, some of them with PhD, I think. So what did you find in terms of when you compare the challenges they are facing to people who have the same background from other countries? Have you tried to see this kind of, is there any...
Yeah, I can talk about the challenges that they were facing in the context of the thesis, but I haven't done this kind of comparison with people from other countries. Mm-hmm. But I'm happy to share their experiences as they relate to me, right? Yeah. So there are a few challenges that there isn't really a point in the thesis that focuses on challenges as such. So this is kind of an amalgam or a collection from across the PhD of the main things that people brought up, reported as their challenges to work. And then maybe later on we can think about how that may apply to other groups. The main one that, and again, we need to keep in mind that everyone I spoke with had higher education. The main one that people mentioned was local experience, lack of local experience. And with that, they mean lack of local Australian work experience. And I found that was quite a mechanism for excluding them from their profession. If we look kind of more broadly on the consequences of that, it pushed them to take on other jobs, it pushed them into phases of unemployment, it pushed them to take on work that is manual, for example, and essentially excluded them really from these opportunities that they thought would be available to them. And local experience also kind of manifests in lack that's in the eyes of employers and local work agents, lack of Australian-related work skills, lack of local references, and local degrees in some cases. Although again, most people that I spoke with had the most recent higher education, tertiary education completed in Australia. But local experience was really identified by them time and again as the most is the most problematic challenge. Then there's the non-recognition of degrees from overseas that figured quite prominently in people's responses. So that could include degrees from Eritrea, but also from other countries. Networks, so crucial. Networks with Australians, networks also with other migrants, also professional associations, and so on. There's the trick of getting that informal, especially connection, right. And for people, especially who were quite recent in Australia, that was definitely a challenge. And of course, there are a lot of industries where networks are really everything. Then there's language that some people spoke about, especially in the early years of resettlement and arrival in Australia, that could be a barrier, although the people I spoke with were in Australia for 3 to 30 years, so for them it was less relevant at the time we spoke, but they spoke about earlier days especially, where this could have been problematic. And then culturally, some people said that they were not selling themselves enough. And they made that actually comparison, so back to your point from before, Ben, they made that comparison to people from other groups who were better at this kind of self-promotion. You know, so Eritreans being more timid, not really self-praising, and so on, some stuff that people said. Discrimination was another challenge some people spoke to, and we kind of covered that. And then institutional support, really critical, infrastructure, from community organizations that were lacking, and people mentioned a fair few times, and also the lack of volunteering opportunities and internship options. I feel like especially volunteering in trying to get that local experience, that could have been really valuable to people. Maybe one last thing on challenges is the need to earn that a lot of people faced early on, especially, but not just, but especially early on, needing to send money to families, needing to support people in different parts of the world. And that obviously pushed them to want to take and also take work that could be outside of their profession.
There's a participant by the name of Dawit. Dawit says in the thesis, you asked him, what happens usually if you say Asmara University? And then he said, no, they wouldn't care. They would ask, what is Asmara University? This is part of the challenges that the participants are facing. And there are so many other stories that your participants also explained of the challenge that they face.
I'm happy maybe to speak to Dawit's story as well. The issue of non-recognition of previous degrees, we were thinking if some employers and universities, as I've heard from some people, don't recognize Asmara University, or it kind of starts with the non-recognition even of Eritrea by some people and some people in these positions of decision-making. If they don't recognize the actual country, what are the chances that they will recognize Asmara University and therefore recognize my degree?
The notion of invisibility.
Yes. So Dawit really struggled with that, and what he was doing, and I think that's another really good strategy that worked for some, is approach a community figure, someone who's also a trusted local because they have been in Australia for a long time. So there would be something of a bridge from Eritrean community, and serve as a bit of a bridge on the one hand, someone that he could approach, someone that he could trust, who will help him out, who will recognize the issues that he's facing because he knows the background story, and on the other hand, someone that will be recognized by Australian society, someone who's been here long enough, who maybe has the professional sort of credentials. So use these community figures really as bridges to authenticate, if you may, degrees that are otherwise not recognized. Yeah, and they're similar. There are a few other people who spoke about that, on how, for example, if it's someone who is more local, more Australian, then that might carry more weight when you are trying to be recognized or have your recommendation. I think there's another person called Joel in the thesis who spoke to the connection that he had with his employer and how his employer would recommend him to go certain ways, and that was really important for him in being able to get a job that is closer to his profession.
So we have kind of covered the challenges that Eritrean migrants, and at least those who participated in your thesis, experienced. But then there is a need for local experience and then qualification recognition. And then after that, there are communities who are strong enough to have these relationships within the professional network and also the migrants themselves. But in terms of Eritreans, these intercultural connections seem to be lacking, at least according to the findings that your participants kind of alluded to.
Mm-hmm.
And this is part of like one of the challenge or the main challenge that Eritrean migrants, especially those who are qualified, have degrees and also have pursued postgrad or higher education in Australia. What are your findings with respect to the intercultural connections and the successes or lack thereof?
So with intercultural connections, I look at two different aspects. One of them is whether ties that are more fleeting, everyday ties that people may have in their neighborhoods with their neighbors, with workmates, with people that they meet in cafes, semi-public spaces, if they scale up in the sense of becoming more enduring in time, becoming closer, so maybe even becoming friends with people, developing a closer relationship, and also transcending the spaces of the initial fleeting encounter. And there's some literature, some research that has been done that claims that these everyday small encounters, that they could actually be quite powerful. And what I found in that sort of first part of that chapter on intercultural connections is that actually they were very, very limited. And I looked at different settings where that was the case, especially work settings, but also, again, neighborhoods, sites of places of worship, cafes. And I found that the connections that people had were mostly with other migrants from other backgrounds, also with, of course, with Eritreans and Habesha people. That was really center to the everyday social lives. But connections with local born non-migrants Australians were very, very minimal, and definitely in terms of scaling up, that really didn't happen much. And that brings us to question some of these research findings, but also the nature of intercultural connections in Australia. And especially so because quite a few of the people that I spoke with were interested in having these connections that might become even friendships and so on. Mm-hmm. But even if you're not looking to be best friends with someone, these connections can be really important for you in terms of, you know, practicing English even, feeling like you belong in Australia, having these different opportunities also in relation to work, getting advice and help from people. This is really crucial. So if we're talking even about terms like integration, these are some of the things that people were interested in. And I really marked the limitations of that sort of scaling up is something that would require more research and more attention, I think, also beyond research circles. There's also another part to that same chapter that looks about practices of living together with difference or indifference. So the term that people have called conviviality, which essentially means sharing a life or living together, and it speaks mostly to everyday practices of intercultural contact. And I try to expand that literature on conviviality to also look at how people negotiate cultural difference between groups that haven't really been looked at. And I'll give you an example. Between Eritreans from different cultural backgrounds, people from different religious backgrounds, even political opinions, and how people manage to negotiate these differences in everyday life, which I think is really important because it might be something that could even be politically beneficial to show that people are having these negotiations, that they are savvy in these multicultural everyday negotiations that is currently not really being discussed. Also, connections between Eritreans and Ethiopians, Eritreans from different backgrounds, Ethiopians from different backgrounds, and also people from other countries in the Horn of Africa.
One of your participants said, yes, we were talking with Solomon earlier about friendship with the mainstream Australians. So how many of us have friends, Aussie friends, Anglo friends? We started counting and we only had a few. So you asked him, between the two of you or other people also? And the answer was, I mean, for me, like, I don't have many. Maybe one or two. They are not even close friends. There are some people I know. And Solomon also said the same thing. And another of your participants by the name of Meron, I had some like friends when I was working in a temporary job, for instance. Like, we used to go for coffee, but like, it doesn't go much beyond that, you know. It doesn't go like much outside the work. Maybe they have like a different interest outside the work area. So these are like instances of forming normal friendships or acquaintances, but they don't go beyond the support network that you need in terms of getting a job or succeeding in a job, like you mentioned earlier, in terms of scaling up.
So yeah, it really varies. I think that both of these examples that you mentioned really speak about the limitations of connections with Australians that people sought out and really interested in trying to build up, and it just didn't happen. Or, you know, there were some connections in at work, but, you know, it might be something like catching up in a kind of work-related setting or function or something like that, but it wouldn't really get into people's homes and their personal sort of maybe one-on-one small friendship group kind of hangout. So that's really, one thing in there. And then in terms of Eritreans from different backgrounds coming together, I found that there's very little that has been written about that. And obviously there's so many divisions in different community groups and so on, even here in the small community or small populace or place like Melbourne. And I mentioned that, but at the same time, we can see all these practices of working together and befriending that I found, and I thought it would be important to highlight. So how people become friends despite speaking a different first language, despite having different religious background, and I think even despite having very different political opinions. So being able to have these arguments, containing these arguments, also with people who are really close friends, and then having some kind of bigger rules that help you with such containment and being able to still move on despite these disagreements and despite these differences, and still having enough to keep you in common, enough that you share. It can be different. It can be interests, it can be humor, it can be hobbies and so forth, that is really plenty for people to befriend around.
Yeah, I think we have been raising the challenge the Eritreans are facing in terms of finding jobs and all these things, and interact or connect with the wider communities. But can you please share us some success stories of Eritreans that they, when they try to pursue their jobs and you see finding some ways to get a decent job, and then we can consider them successful migrants in Melbourne?
Sure, I can maybe try and distill some of the responses that have worked for some people, that some kind of responses to challenges also with work that through them they managed to get jobs closer to their professions. It doesn't mean that this really worked for everyone. These are individual cases. It's just some stuff that worked for them. One thing was volunteering and internships that people found, especially some institutions that might do something like work training, work skills, and will also have a work placement that a couple of people have found really useful in getting closer back to their professions. Another thing was local education. We kind of spoke to that. Obviously, local education is not a guarantee. Some people it worked more, for some people it worked less. And there's all sorts of questions that come up in relation to that. You know, you invest all that time and resources And in the end, it might not be successful, so it's not a guarantee, but it can work for some. Some networks that people have joined, associational networks around their profession, trying to scale back up. And then links could be formal, but also informal, with their teachers or people that they've known as caseworkers when they first arrived, former bosses, and so on. And these networks have in some cases been helpful to them. And the thing that I found maybe most extraordinary was just the diversity of connections that people had with other Eritreans and also Ethiopians, and how these connections have helped them to get work. In many cases, it was not necessarily in their professions, but still very, very helpful. So all of these networks and interconnections that we may call maybe more community related. And yeah, some of them I wasn't really expecting, or I wasn't expecting how common they were. So they included, for example, stuff like handing over jobs to other people that they knew. So if their term and the position was coming to an end, and they would know of someone, they would keep them in mind, hand the job over. Obviously providing information and advice. Also people who were really central in different Eritrean communities who were kind of go-to people for that, and others found that incredibly useful. Also meeting them, really, to have job-related kind of meetings, orientation meetings, or, okay, what can I do in Australia or in Melbourne with my degree? And they would give them all sorts of recommendations. And then internships, kind of like improvised internships, where you would go with someone maybe in the middle of the night to the care center where they worked, and they will introduce you to the job very informally. Your boss will obviously not know about this. Or sorry, you will get a good taste of what the job may be like, and then later on you may apply. And some employers also sought out specifically people who are like, I'm putting quotations, the people that already work with them. So I met a few people who used that to then advertise about jobs that were coming up and could be relevant. Again, there could be more manual jobs than professional jobs. And then maybe the last one, materially, how people shared different, it could be businesses, it could be taxis, working together, so really supporting others through their connections. And I found that to be really powerful, and also I think under-researched.
So we are at the end of our conversation. The research itself, the methodology, the way that you approached and you selected the participants, and also the recruitment methods that you used. Can you please shed like a general idea on your research, the conclusion or the finding at the end, and if there's any kind of gaps of research that you filled by having studied this thesis or this subject, and also the future directions?
I used a research methodology called ethnography, which is literally the writing. It means literally writing people. It refers both to the methods themselves. It builds on longer term connection, taking into account context, a bit of this kind of juggle between insider and outsider perspectives. But also ethnography also relates to the accounts that we produce at the end of the day, monographs, the description of cultural backgrounds and circumstances and practices of people. So I can position myself within that research tradition of ethnography. In terms of the methods, that meant spending quite a lot of time with people. It included methods like participant observation that I focused in some spots, including cafes in different Western suburbs, especially one cafe, meeting people, spending time with them, going into different places with them. Altogether, it was 14 months of the research, around 2016, 2017. Other methods were ongoing conversations that I've had, especially with four people whom I call in the thesis key participants, and interviews altogether with 18 people. So these are the methods. The sites, again, were in the western suburbs of Melbourne and the central business district, CBD, down here. And participants were highly educated, lived in Australia for between three and 30 years, mostly men, 15 men and 3 women, and mostly in the 30s, 40s and 50s. So the findings for the different chapters on discrimination specifically that we kind of touched on, local experience, where essentially I'm making a call to try and unearth and bring into life these other experiences people have in Australia, but also beyond Australia, from the time before Australia, and write more about that. And at the same time, calling out that phenomenon of local experience and how that is used as a mechanism of exclusion. Also looking at some of the paradoxes of precarity or work-related vulnerability, and how that precarity was kind of moved through by people, how they were using, for example, manual jobs to move beyond manual jobs and try to get back into their professions. We also touched on intercultural connections. I think I discussed it pretty briefly. But there's also conclusions and findings that are more broadly for the thesis as a whole, and they relate to areas like mobilities that are quite complex. So discussing different mobilities of Eritreans, they're quite diverse. Geographic mobilities, how people move to Australia, before Australia, within Australia, to Melbourne. Also social mobility in terms of their social position within Australian society. Work-related mobilities, where people keep on trying to get to their professions. And existential mobilities, so a sense that life is moving somewhere, that we are not stuck, which some people have called existential immobility. And from mobilities, I take that into the area of motility, which is a capacity for movement. I think these capacities are really important. And so the thesis more generally speaks also about potentialities, giving attention to capacities that might not be realized. So for example, how people are keen to have these friendships and connections outside Eritrean and Habesha communities with Australians also. So these desires are there, but they might not be realized. And I think these desires in themselves are worth the attention, and we need to talk about that more. The same thing happens with passions that people spoke about in relation to their professions. So people who might be trapped in quotations outside of their professions, but are very keen to go back to that, and are doing that in all sorts of ways. They are attempting to go back. They keep some kind of connection to their previous jobs through hobbies, through professional associations sometimes, and so forth. So that potentiality that we can define also as maybe a present pregnant with a future, that potentiality is really important. I think needs more research attention in the future. Finally, ambivalence. I found a fair bit of ambivalence in terms of work circumstances. So people who are well experienced, have a lot of skills, are ready to make a serious contribution to Australian society, but for different reasons are left outside of their professions. There's an ambivalence about that. Mobility and immobility, an ambivalence between being mobile and some moments of being stuck, this stuckedness, and maybe a sense of ambivalence about Australian society more generally. So Australian society is really generous, really welcoming on the one hand, but also we find all these limitations where these jobs are kind of within sight but out of our grasp.
So this is the reason you called it ambivalent motion.
That is true, yes. I think in second thought I might have changed the title, but yeah, that was the rationale.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, why ambivalent motion? Why describing your thesis in these two words?
Yeah, I think in hindsight I might have changed that to something more around potentialities or capacities or lasting motions might be a better title, but now it's too late. Thank you very much, Ibrahim and Ben, for having me, for having the opportunity really to share the findings of this research. And again, I want to send a shout out, a huge thank you to everyone who's been involved in this project for all their support and generosity over the years. Thank you very much.
Want to hear more stories like this? Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.